Hey guys, this is Dallas. We have a special episode here for you. This is a previously recorded episode of Al's other podcast, Destination Nightmare. We just kind of wanted to give you a taste of it, and we hope you enjoy it. And the gang will be back next week for business as usual. So enjoy this episode, and in the meantime, read more comics.
To see examples of what we talked about on this episode, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Two Dimension Podcast,
the comic book podcast
with no direction.
Building tall with a stone wall around, there's a rubber room. When a man sees things and hears sounds, it's not there he's headed for, the rubber room. Illusions in a twisted mind to save from self-destruction. It's the rubber room where a man can run into the wall till his strength makes him fall and lie still and wait for help in the rubber room. From his blurry vision of doom, a sign in the rubber room. The man in the room right next to mine screams a woman's name, hits the wall in vain. He's in the rubber room. I hear footsteps pounding on the floor. God, I hope they don't stop at my door. I'm in the rubber room. Now they've come to get me, but they find I'm a-screaming pretty words, trying to make them rhyme. I'm in the rubber room.
I'm recording now, though, because it's Destination Nightmare episode 12, and I guess it's hammer time, Don.
No, I'm not doing that song right now.
You're not doing like can't touch this? Okay.
Super free.
I guess recently we found out that we're both, well, I knew I was, but I didn't know you were a big fan of Hammer Horror.
I didn't know either. There are certain movies that I really love, and then I just started finding out they were all from the Hammer Film Company. I absolutely love them.
And then I loaned you this box set here, the Hammer Horror series that came out a few years ago, and you remembered a lot of these movies. Well, I think it started with you mentioning a couple of movies, right?
Yeah, well, one movie I always remembered, I didn't know the title, was Brides of Dracula. I saw it late night TV, and again, the color just really staggered me. As you had said, the stories are really imaginative, you know, they're really unique. And I was telling my mom, since I was over at a friend's house staying the night, I think it was on Night Owl Theater, they showed this movie, but I just remember the color, the story, everything about it was fantastic. And, you know, fast forward 40 years later, and you were telling me about it was Brides of Dracula.
Yeah.
And which is absolutely a fantastic film. The color is strong. The second movie on this set was Curse of the Werewolf.
Yeah, we'll talk about that one a little later, but yeah.
Well, I'd seen that one in black and white.
Oh, you saw it in black and white?
Yeah, they showed that in afternoon television in Oklahoma in the 60s. But it was in black and white. I mean, we had a color TV. But I guess a lot of the TV stations got films in black and white.
Yeah, they
the time,
did.
That's all they showed.
Yeah.
Because there were some cartoons that I always thought was black and white, because all through the 70s, they showed them on Oklahoma TV in black and white. And then when I started getting DVDs, they weren't colorized. They were originally put out in color in the 50s. So I guess a lot of stations had old black and white, you know, stuff with color work. But Curse of the Werewolf, I watched the movie, I've seen it a couple of times on...
So it's on Svengoolie, right?
No, I never saw it on Svengoolie. It was always black and white. They showed it in a...
Oh, back in the 60s.
I think it was Dialing for Dollars is what I saw it on an afternoon TV.
Yeah, I remember those things.
Like
yeah.
In 68, I think.
Dialing for Dollars Theater, yeah.
And I think I saw it again in late night TV.
Maybe the CBS late night movie?
It might, well, because that would have been a color on that one.
They said black and white.
It was
again.
One of the local, you know, late night horror shows, you know, they had on the weekends. Because I saw it the second time, but again, it was black and white. I never saw it in color.
Until recently.
Yeah, until I saw it on your set.
And the colors are beautiful on the movie. I mean, they're just as nice. Same production team. I think Jack Asher and Terrence Fisher was the director.
Yeah, they had a look. Hammer had a look.
Yeah, they sure did.
And that's one thing I never realized, because you and I were talking, 1 million BC, you know, the Harry Haas and Raquel Welch film. I love that movie. I've always liked it, but I knew it was United Artists, just, you know. That's when we're talking about distributors.
Yeah, yeah.
I never attested that all these movies were from one company. I just know from, you know, they were random movies like a hodgepodge of stuff coming out randomly. So I never knew that. It's kind of like the Godzilla movies. Everybody talks about the Toho. But it was always different people releasing them with different studios. So I never really attested to a look. Shaw Brothers films in Hong Kong, they always had a look. You know, that color and the lighting.
Yeah, they sure did, yeah.
But Hammer Horror had the same thing. And then you said something that almost all the movies have in common, and that is?
Oh, yes, the ladies with the with the low-cut dresses and the ample breasts.
Yeah, I remember you were saying all the breasts.
Yeah, that was, besides the scary and the blood, back when you were a kid, you noticed, like, the heaving bosoms that are prevalent throughout those movies, and a lot of the women, not all, some are more conservatively dressed, but the younger ones usually are showing a lot. And that's the thing, they were selling sex and violence. And,
well, you know, when you're 12 years old watching a late night TV. Wow,
yeah, when you're 12 years old, you're with your friends, you're in your room, your parents aren't around, you're watching this, you're like, yeah, because if your parents are around, they might go, no, and then switch the channel. I know plenty of kids that had to sneak out in the living room and watch movies because their parents wouldn't let them. I even know people that their parents would take away their magazines, Monster, they wouldn't let them buy Monster magazines. They got nightmares, which I kind of understand because then they kind of like interrupt them in the middle of the night. You know, Mom, I'm scared, the Wolf Man. It's like, yeah, okay, well, no more famous monsters for you. So
that's what my mom used to always say, was she didn't understand why we get so terrified of them. Because they always look so silly.
Oh, well,
yeah, but I guess it's just, a lot of times you didn't see the movie. It was just stuff in the magazine, the image. And I guess if you saw the whole movie, maybe it wouldn't be so bad. But it's just, what was in your mind was worse than what you could ever see.
Because, like, we both watched The Curse of the Werewolf, and the werewolf is only in it probably, like, in full makeup for 10 minutes of the movie, maybe. The rest of it is just, like, you know, action and drama and all that stuff. But when you look at famous monsters and you open up those pictures, you're like, oh my God, this is incredibly horrible. So yeah, that's part of it too.
But that's one thing in these movies, you didn't need the monster the whole time. The movie was still good enough to keep your interest. The story was good, and you know,
the actors were good.
So, you know, I mean, the monster show up a couple of times at the end. It was always a build up, and that was kind of nice. You know?
And they were bloodier. I mean, that was... Those were, no, I wouldn't say those were the bloodiest movies I first saw, but I remember when I first saw these in the late 60s, maybe, or whenever I did, they were kind of, they were stronger, they were more graphic than, you know, the usual Universal or AIP things, or they were a little more adult. Let's put it that way. And the other thing too is that back in Britain, there was a book that came out called The History of Horror Movies by Dennis Gifford. It was all the Walden books in the 70s. And I remember I bought it, and I remember looking through it, and they had like lobby cards and posters. And in Britain, a lot of these movies are certified X, meaning six, you can't see it unless you're over 16.
Really?
Yeah. And I was thinking, oh my God, they have X-rated versions of these movies. I got to see this. You know, but what it was is that over there, there were more censorship.
And what year was this?
Okay, these were the earlier ones.
Oh.
I don't know when Certificate X ended, but in the 60s, maybe in the 70s it ended. But then again, in the 70s, there still might have been some kind of rating. But I know in the 60s, and maybe even in the late 50s, when these movies were coming up, they were rated X over there.
So was The Fly.
Okay,
there you go. I'd be surprised when it was rated X.
Over there, yeah, they're really. We should ask Steve Robinson about that.
Yeah, the rated X, it started out, it wasn't pornography or bad movies like that. What the X rating was supposed to be was for adults. It was for, like Al just said, or Dr. Morbius just said, it was...
Or both of those guys.
16 and over, or over 16. And that was what it was supposed to be. What happened was the porn industry just latched on to it, rated X and then triple X and the whole thing.
But
X,
but this is British X. This is an American X. American, it was rated G or whatever. It's a British rating. It's for them.
But in the United States, they had an X rating as well.
Yeah.
But it didn't last too long, and then it was gone. I think now they changed it to NC-17 or something, which I guess
is
gone too.
Well, Midnight Cowboy was a mainstream X rated movie, the first one that I remember.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing the billboard in the theater near my house. I was like, ooh, wow. But nowadays, you probably can watch that during the day on IFC with no big deal if they would even play it. But back then, there was a couple of scenes. There was a couple of scenes that I won't go into. They weren't even, like, that explicit. But the idea of what they were doing made them get X-rated. Yeah, it was John Voight and some kid or whatever. Yeah, in a movie theater. Yeah, John Voight even said that's the reason why that movie got that rating. It wasn't because we showed anything. It was just we implied this and, blah, blah, blah. But over in Britain, not in any instance, in Britain, these movies were rated X.
Well, Steve Robinson, who he mentioned, is from Scunthorpe, England. And he does not like movies. Whenever you talk about movies, he's always like, Ebenezer Scrooge, movies, waste of time. And, after I've been watching these movies and you and I have been talking about them, I went up and asked him. I said, "I know you don't care about movies. Did you ever see any of those Hammer horror films?" Immediately, it was an 8-year-old boy. He just lit up and, "Oh yeah." And he was telling me in his school, they had a movie club. And one time they showed Steve McQueen's Bullet, which is a great movie. And then they showed Bride of Frankenstein. And he says, "I'll never forget that." And then I brought up the whole thing you said about the breast. And again, as Rye smiled, he goes, "Oh yeah. Just imagine showing that to a school full of 14-year-old boys." Well, like I said, it was, when I was 12, I was like, what?
Yeah.
I was telling my wife about that, and then we watched Phantom of the Opera, which is my favorite of the whole
thing. Hammer.
Yeah, the Hammer one. And when at one point it shows the girl, in an evening dress at the restaurant, and I said, "Oh, there's the breast." Well, yeah, it was an evening dress. It was a little bit low cut, but it's not what I was talking about when that was kind of tastefully.
Now, in Curse of the Werewolf, at the beginning, the servant girl, that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, they were in all of them. They have them.
And then, like, as the years went on, and Hammer started out they started out in the 30s. Then they shut down for a while, and they came back in the 50s, and they did some kind of B-movie mysteries, and then they did a science fiction called The Quatermass Experiment, which is based on a radio play. And then after that hit, then they decided to do the horror movies.
Mm.
And then, like, when they started doing the horror movies, that really became successful. And then I think I read somewhere they teamed up with Universal, and then they started the distribution. Then they started doing the remakes of The Mummy. They already did Frankenstein, and I think Dracula was at Universal, but then they hooked up with them and did The Mummy. They did The Curse of the Werewolf, which was originally supposed to be a Spanish Inquisition movie, but then they got the censors to turned them down. And they would do other ones like zombies and the reptile and other things. But yeah, they definitely joined up a partnership with Universal. And they kind of, in a way, when you're a kid, they were more effective in a lot of ways than the Universal movies. The Universal movies were classic, wonderful movies. But these were like, you know, more in your face. You know what I mean? They were bloodier. They were sexier. They were just like everything, like all the European stuff. And they opened up the floodgates for all that stuff. Because when the Hammers hit big, then all the other, like the Italian studios, started doing movies, and then they came over here, but since they were in Italian, they got dubbed. And then if you were a child of the 60s and the 70s, you saw tons of dubbed movies, including all the Hercules and all that
which
stuff.
Which were awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, now another thing, too, that you mentioned about that you only saw The Curse of the Werewolf in black and white.
Right.
Now, it is true, I think, I'm pretty sure about this, that the stations would get color or black and white print. Maybe the station only had a black and white print, but another reason why sometimes they showed black and white prints was because the color had gone bad on the print. So it was so washed out that they turned the color off.
Oh.
So you wouldn't complain. But since you saw it in 68, I wouldn't think that the color was washed out on that movie. I'm thinking that they only had a black and white print. It was circulating around town from one station to the other. And in 1968, a lot of people didn't have color TV.
Right. Like I said, we got one in 67. Like I said, we always talk about the Batman, the Adam West Batman show.
Right.
I always saw it black and white. It wasn't until like 77 when I started seeing the color, when they brought it back in the afternoons. So, well, I never realized it was like this. That was lavish. It was always black and white.
Yeah, that's what would happen. It's that's early in the game. They probably had black and white prints only. But I remember in the 70s, they were late night TV, they would show some like old, they would probably, I think it was probably in the mid 70s, they were showing some of those like Hercules movies, some of the cheaper ones, you know.
Yeah.
And I remember watching one of them and the color was so bad, it was red. Because some of those Eastman color prints, the color, it was a cheap stock and the color would die out. So sometimes instead of watching a red print that was like painful almost to your eyes, they would just shut the color off and go, it's a black and white movie. And it wouldn't look that good because it was made for color.
Right.
Because when you do a black and white movie, you can tell the shading is a lot more, you know, black and white. So yeah, they did that a lot, but I'm sure it was because it was early in the game that you saw the black and white print of Curse of the Werewolf. But yeah, they did Curse of the Werewolf. I think, I'm not sure if they did another werewolf movie, they may have, but they did, let's see, The Mummy. They were supposed to do The Invisible Man. They didn't do The Invisible Man. They didn't do anything like The Creature, but The Reptile was kind of like a female, kind of, you know, whatever. And then they just did a lot of remakes. They did a lot of Dracula movies. They did a lot of Frankenstein movies, but with the emphasis on Dr. Frankenstein, Peter Cushing, more so than the monster.
Well, that was the thing about these films. They never looked like cheap knockoffs, like, well, Frankenstein is big, let's do one. They had a different approach to everything. You know, and we talked about, I think, the last episode of this show, Brides of Dracula, when Peter Cushing, you know, when he was bit, and, you know, what he did with the burning and the holy water. They were really clever and imaginative, and they never stopped. But I never watched it thinking, oh, they're just Universal wannabes that aren't as good.
No way.
They were unique. And they were fantastic. And the Phantom of the Opera, they showed in Oklahoma on their CBS affiliate in 1972. And what was odd, I didn't know that was a Hammer film. But it was they were advertising that, really building it up for all summer about, you know, Phantom of the Opera's coming on. And then one night they showed it, and from what I remember, the entire city basically shut down and watched it. Everybody watched it. My whole family sat in the living room and watched it. One of the greatest movies I had ever seen. And when I was watching on the set, I watched it again. I thought, that's my favorite one. I mean, it's a really strong movie, a really strong, you know, I mean, I know the story's strong and, you know, it's been operas and everything else. But in other versions, you know, the Bela Lugosi version is really
famous. Lon Chaney.
Oh, it was Lon Chaney?
Lon Chaney.
But the makeup for him was just staggering. But
well, see, that makeup and that image in that movie will always scare me. It will scare me as a kid. So So that, I remember seeing the Claude Rains, and that didn't do anything for me. I'm going to watch this one because I've never watched it. And, like, I'm gonna, you know, I'll watch it and I'll enjoy it for what it is. But to me, it's like nothing tops Lon Chaney as a fan.
And this one doesn't either. I mean, when he takes the mask off, it's not...
It's just like burns on his face. It's not like that cadaver.
But the movie itself had so much heart to it.
Okay.
And, you know, I watched it and then I got my wife to watch it with me. And she really liked it. She said that was a really, really strong movie. The story is really strong.
Did you ever see the Claude Rains version of it?
No, and I was wondered if this version was, because I always heard Claude Rains played it. And I thought maybe that was it.
It was more of a musical.
I never saw that.
A lot of songs in it. Yeah, I saw it as a kid. Well, you know, there was movies that I saw as a kid, like that version, and I always saw the Charles Laughton Hunchback, and to me, that's my favorite one.
Well, he was a great actor.
He was perfect in that role. You know, and I was watching, there's this thing on YouTube, it's called Trailers from Hell. It's like a bunch of trailers, and they're hosted by directors like John Landis, Guillermo del Toro, Joe Dante, whatever. And del Toro says an interesting thing about The Hunchback, the Charles Laughton version. He says that was one of the last movies where they really treated horror like as a big, lavish thing. After that, like in the 40s and 50s, it became more like B-movie exploitation. But at that point, or maybe a little bit, and still in the 40s, they were still doing big budget. But they were actually like thinking of it as like, hey, this is a grand, big, classic movie, not... you know, not part one of a double bill with another movie. So yeah, they were thought of highly, and I think Hammer brought that back.
Yeah, I think so too.
With the production, I mean, they were not expensively made movies because I think they even filmed them. I'm pretty sure they rented a house, which ended up being called Bray Studios, and that's where they filmed a lot of the early movies. So they have that look to them, that has the castle, and it looks like real gothic, you know. Exterior and interior, and of course you can do that in Europe because you have all the historical buildings. So they made them look a lot more expensive than they really were. They brought that back to the movies. I think that's why we reacted to them the way we did. Plus the colors and the production value.
Oh yeah, they were fun to watch. They're visually beautiful to look at. And again, I guess since we grew up in a time, I really like to see films from the 60s because it had a certain look to it. The lighting, the flat color they used, even though it was a bright, lavish color, it was always kind of a flat look. The Shaw Brothers movies had that kind of color as well.
Yeah, they did.
Which is my favorite. But yeah, these movies I can't say enough about. I really enjoyed watching them.
Well, you know, the thing too is, like, these movies came out in the 60s, late 50s, 60s. They really wanted to take advantage of color.
Right.
Because a lot of the movies before black and white, so a lot of the movies of the 60s took advantage of the colors, the scope of the colors, and your eyes are like feasting on this, like, you know, incredible. But then as the years went on, they became more monotone and grayer, and now it's just like tones of blue and brown and whatever.
Well, part of it is something new. When I was in college, I really liked sculpture. I took a few sculpture courses. In the very beginning, Dr. Williams told us, the first piece you're going to do is going to be on limestone. He said, the reason I choose limestone is it's an ugly stone. There's nothing to it. It's just kind of a gray. And he said, whenever, if he shows pink serpentine green serpentine or pink alabaster, you get so caught up in the beauty of the stone, the grain of the stone, and you start making this piece just to show off the beauty of that. He says, you need to design a strong piece that is strong and looks nice, even with an ugly stone. So anyway, we started with that. And I thought about it. I remember George Harrison was talking about, he put out an album of, he got a synthesizer, and it's just an album of synthesizer sounds. And he said, remember people used to do that? Well, yeah, that's the thing. You get it, and all of a sudden everything's just real heavy, and it kind of gets dated. And that was the same.
Is that Wonderwall music?
I just read him an interview when he put out, whatever that album was that had Devil's Radio and,
I can't remember what
it was. Put it on like 87 or
88. Yeah, that was a good record.
It was pretty good. But it was in Musician Magazine, he was talking about it. I thought that's what Dr. Williams always told us. But that was the thing, when color came out, it was like you know, a fruit fiesta. It was just nothing but bright colors, which I really like.
Yeah, I do too.
But sometimes it gets to be too much. It's it just goes over the top. For some odd reason, it was when the 70s came around, like 71, 72, 73. That's when all the television productions became those Norman Lear, and they were all kind of drab.
Yeah, color you got that right. Away. You got that right.
And even, again, going earlier, that Steve McQueen movie, Bullet, the colors, it looked, I guess it looked more natural if you had your own camera and could film it, is what they were doing. And then later when the digital stuff started coming out, what was it, Sky Captain?
You know, that was an interesting looking movie.
But everything was all kind of gray and blue.
It was, but it was interesting.
And a lot of the heavy CGI movies, they're all kind of washed out gray-brown or gray-blue.
Yeah, they are.
And which isn't
except the cartoons.
Yeah, except the cartoons. Now, Lord of the Rings, the colors were good, but Lord of the Rings is supposed to be kind of an earthy type film, but the colors I thought on that were pretty strong. But yeah, every era.
Yeah, every era has its own look or whatever. And the 60s had a great look to it. Even the 70s did, too, to a certain extent.
Somewhere.
There's still a lot of extravagance going on. And the 80s was kind of, with the videos were very, the videos especially were very colorful.
Well, the movies got colorful, too, with those synthesized soundtracks that just don't age well these days.
No, they don't age well. My 80s movies are okay. I mean, I like a lot of them, those soundtracks kind of like,
they sound kind of buzzy.
Yeah, that Jan Hammer, Miami Vice sound to them. Not as good, though. A lot cheesier and cheaper. Maybe like a bad Keith Emerson thing going on or whatever.
Yeah, because Keith Emerson did that movie Nighthawks that I really liked.
And it wasn't a bad score, but it influenced a lot of lesser.
Rick Wakeman was doing some soundtracks for stuff. Yeah, it was all that synthesized, which...
Some people are good at it.
Yeah, but part of the thing is, if you're somebody that grew up in the 90s or 2000s, you hear that stuff, oh, God, it's so dated. But, you know, if you were around in the 80s, well, that was the new thing that was happening, and you wanted more of it. That's the thing. That's the time. Some things don't age as well. But I have to say, the Horror Hammer, the music, I don't really quite remember the music so much, but it propelled the movie. You know, it wasn't like...
The music was by a gentleman. A lot of it was by a guy called James Bernard, who was a very good composer.
And
he was pretty good. But it was funny. I ran an interview with him once, and they said, well, how do you come up with the themes? And he was basically saying that a lot of them were just based upon the title, the name of the character. If it was Dracula, he'd go, Dracula. And that would be the way he built the themes. Yeah. Not all of them, but he specified that one, Dracula, and it made sense in a way.
Well, when I watch the movies, and I can't stress to you, when Dr. Morbius slimmed me this disc set, I talked to him, you know, getting together for another show, and I said, well, thanks. You do understand you're not getting this box back.
Yeah, right.
And joking aside, I kind of meant it. Of course, I'm not a jerk, and I'm going to give it back. But
I would cry.
Yeah. But I want to get my own. But I really enjoyed it. And I can't think of anything I saw that I thought, that didn't age well with that. I mean, there was sometimes a couple of the movies I just didn't enjoy as much, and I thought the story was kind of weak. But we'll get into that later on.
Episodes and stuff like that.
But the soundtracks, it wasn't like, oh, that's dreadful. It just it worked for the film. It propelled it. But it wasn't something I thought of.
In most cases, it was a classical theme, so it had that classic. The look of the movies was classic, and the soundtrack was classic. It wasn't like spiky haircuts from the 80s.
No, it wasn't, like, but I mean, the music was fine for what it was. I'm sure if I heard the music separately, I'd probably appreciate it more.
I have a CD somewhere with something.
Well, a friend of mine brought in, years ago at work, I found at the library, it was a two CD set, and it was all the... you know, great film scores for like the past 40 years or something. Now, you know, they had Jaws, of course, you know that. You know, it had Star Wars, it had Close Encounters. We all knew those. But I was really surprised, like Lawrence of Arabia, which is a movie I love, but I never thought of music in that one either. To me, it fit the movie and propelled it, but it didn't take away. But when you hear it separately, oh man, that's something. But I never separated it from the movie. And but there was a lot of stuff like that went in there, and I just never realized, oh wow, that's the music. So I'm gonna say the Hammer Horror, you know, the music to it, soundtracks. If I heard it separately, I'd probably just fall in love. I think it was great, but for the movie, it did what it's supposed to do, just add to the movie and make it better.
Yeah, definitely the early ones, they did a great job. I mean, I was like everything else, after a couple hundred movies, you start losing your steam a little bit. And imitators crept in. There was another studio, Viamicus, that was doing similar movies, and another one called Tigron, I think, was doing similar movies. So, you know, they kind of like, they lost their way in, like, I think in the 80s, maybe. But they're back again, and they're producing new movies.
Yeah.
Yeah, they stopped for a while. They were bought out by some guy. They did TV. They did a lot of TV. They did something called the Hammer House of Horror, which was a TV series. And then I think they're back now as of 2007 making movies. And I think there was one of them called Let Me In, which was a vampire movie.
Yes. Now, I saw the...
Yeah,
the,
there you go.
My brother's family, it's Netflix. My brother doesn't get cable. He doesn't bother with local TV sometimes, but... His family's always watching the Netflix. They just go on there. And when I went down there, they wanted me to show Let Me In. Or Let the Right One In.
That was the Swedish original one.
And that's what we saw was the Swedish one. And my nephew didn't like the American version. My brother said that he liked that one as well. He says it's good, too. But he really enjoyed the Sweden. I like to see movies where they show other ways of life. And so you get to see Sweden. You know, you get to see... there's things in Sweden. I mean, people are people. But you get to see a different way of life and how they lived and all that. And I really enjoyed the movie. The story was unique. The story was strong. To me, the story was really bittersweet and sad. You know, but... Again, it was a movie that really struck me. And it was unique from everything else that's... I've heard some people talk about both versions of the film. I guess both versions stand up. But I didn't realize that was a Hammer film.
It wasn't originally. It was a Swedish film, and Hammer did a remake of it.
Oh, so Hammer did the remake. I never saw that one. But
yeah.
I've heard nothing but good things about that one as well.
Yeah. It's not a bad movie. Anyway, let's take a break now, and then we're going to come back, and I guess we're going to talk about The Curse of the Werewolf. The first movie. No, the first movie is about Dracula, but... The first one that I watched off that box set was The Curse of the Werewolf, so we'll talk about that, and then we'll be right back.
Okay.
Prepare to scream. The creeping, crawling flesh eaters cover the body in the most vile experiment ever devised. Flesh feast. Morbid horror in shock-throbbing color. Thus on the same program. A ghastly tale drenched in clots of blood, a taste of blood, and teenage strangler. A new Bluebeard preying on budding teeny boppers. Don't miss them. Rated PG.
Welcome to Oakwood Hospital, where pleasure is the best medicine. We're the Candy Stripe Nurses, and we operate best in private rooms.
Do you sleep with every guy that asks you?
Now what is the matter with you? Don't you ever get turned on?
Candy Stripe Nurses. The new motion picture that lays bare the after-hours operations of the girls in red and white. In the sheets or on the streets, they're volunteers for action.
Oh, playing doctor was never so stimulating.
What are you doing?
Candy Stripe Nurses. They're young, they're eager, they're horizontal, and their bedroom care is real intensive. So for fast relief, take two Candy Stripe Nurses and go straight to bed. Candy Stripe Nurses from New World Pictures in color.
Rated R.
Every few minutes a baby is born in America. And every few minutes somebody dies. That's the cycle of life. The important thing is that the dead are supposed to stay dead. But somewhere, somehow, something has gone wrong. Scientists have been experimenting with a sonar device to make our food supply grow. But they've unleashed a terror beyond description. They've awakened the dead. Run home, lock your doors, bolt your attics, and seal off your basements. And whatever you do, don't open the window. They tampered with nature, and now we must pay the price. For those of you with a taste for zombies and the living dead, comes a nightmare tale that won't go away. Don't open the window. A special weekend late show from Filmways, rated R.
Came from a land of brutality and evil. It came from terror and fear. The curse of the werewolf that was laid on a baby who grew into a man possessed by a monster. To this Spanish town, the night brought drinking and dancing, music and girls, and the moon. The full moon that turned an innocent man into a savage beast. The curse of the werewolf. A man possessed by a frenzied lust to kill and kill and kill. The curse of the werewolf. A man possessed by a desperate need for love, who found in Christina all the passionate sincerity of youth.
Christina, do you love me? Will you marry me, Christina?
You say you love me, will you marry me?
Yes. Yes, I will.
All right, we're back, and we're going to go talking about Hammer Horror, and what we're going to talk about is The Curse of the Werewolf, starring Oliver Reed.
The Curse of the Werewolf, I saw this when I was a kid. There are certain images of it that I always remember. I just always remember when they're out in the field, and the one guy is complaining about, I guess his goat was killed, and the dog was killed, guarding the goats, and they thought it was a wolf. And the man that was supposed to take care of the grounds was there with a gun, kind of perplexed, because he did shoot something. But it didn't kill it, it got away. Of course, you know, the goat herder was really upset about you're paid to take care of our lands and you're not doing it. Then it showed a fight in, you know, the municipality's office about it. And then it showed the kid, you know, that became Oliver Reed, and he's laying in the bed with a gut wound. He was shot.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, I saw this in black and white, and I remember he said, "Help me, Father," and he turned his hands over, and his palms were, you know,
hairy, burning. Yeah.
And that was a really striking image. And then later on, I remember the whole, at the end, you know, how the movie ended. But when you watch the whole film together, it starts out really strong. When you see the whole story of, you know, what was it, the Baron that had a big, he got married.
Yeah, the Baron was having, like, at the beginning of the movie, the Baron's having, like, a festival, he's having, like, a party for him and his wife, and, like, a beggar knocks on the door, and even the guy who always answers the door says, "Get out of here," yeah. And then the Baron goes, "Who is that?" He goes, "It's a beggar, let him in," and then the Baron's, like, a total a-hole.
Oh, yeah.
And he's got a young wife, a hot young wife, who feels sorry for the beggar, but the Baron decides he's going to make fun of him and, like, you know, gets him drunk and throws a chicken wing at him and makes him, like,
dance.
Act like a dance and act like a dog. So at the beginning, you're already seeing, like, what the deal is.
Well, it starts out with the beggar coming into the town and trying to get food, and everybody says the Baron has all the food. You know,
yeah.
So you might do well if you went up there. But they're all sarcastic. The people, you know, aren't doing well. They're not happy. And when they say that, immediately the beggar's kind of cartoony. And so he decides
he
will go. And when he goes there, like I said, the guard is like, "Just get out of here." But it's almost like disdain. And like I said, the Baron, it was, I guess, his wedding day. or a big celebration. Like you said, he had a young wife. But the Baron was like this really horrifying, lecherous cartoon character.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he went through there and the beggar did all the stuff he was saying, it was just a nightmare. But the thing was, is when the Baron would make fun of him, the people were kind of aghast at it. And the next thing you know, they turned
laugh.
Just as bad as him. And they were, you know, it was like a mob rule.
Yeah.
And then finally the Baron's wife, new wife, was really upset at how he's treating him. Says, get him out of here. And they threw him in the dungeon.
Well, what happened, too, was that he said, he's your pet. And then, like, she was like, well, give him some food or whatever. And he, like, makes him beg for food. And then as the Baron goes to leave with the wife, the beggar's, like, smiling. And he goes, like, hey, to the Baron, have, like, a good night. And the Baron, like, gets insulted by this. And he goes, lock him in the...
That's right.
In the dungeon. And they lock him in the dungeon. And then when he's in the dungeon, then you meet the guy who feeds him in the dungeon and his daughter, the little mute.
Yeah, that was basically the jailkeeper. It was actually, for jailkeeper, a very kind
man. It was a nice jailkeeper, yeah.
And his daughter, she couldn't speak.
She's mute, yeah.
And but, you know, it was a fine-looking girl, and the kind of jailkeeper was saying, why don't you give him the food? He's your friend.
And, yeah, right.
You know, the beggar was, you know, always nice to her. And she gave him the food, and that was basically...
And she felt sorry for him, you could tell.
And like I said, the beggar was, you know... And when he said that to the Baron about have a nice night, I think he was just happy he got food and wasn't taking offense to it.
But he was, I think in his face, like, I felt that in his face he was also kind of like going like, hey, you know,
well,
have a good time because it was a wedding night or whatever, and the Baron was kind of like, you know...
That's when it all went sour, but he threw him in a dungeon. But I'm watching it, really enjoying the film, says, okay, this is another unique take on it.
Yeah.
And then it turned really upside down.
Well, yeah, because basically, like, I think after that, many years have passed, and the guy, the beggar, is still in the dungeon, and he's like this scraggly, monstrous-looking dude. And, of course, the young girl is now a grown woman, Yvonne Romaine, the actress, who is very well-built, let's put it that way. And the cleavage, of course, the famous hammer cleavage, is there all in all its glory. And she's like, you know, feeding him. But then I think she goes up, somehow or another she gets up to the Baron's room, and the Baron starts like hitting on her. And now it's been years, and he's like this hideous looking like monster with scabs on his face.
He looks like the witch from Snow White. He looks like a cartoon character. Yeah, he has all these really horrifying scabs. His face is kind of grayish white. And... Again, he looks like a Disney puppet or something.
Yeah, that's right.
He's not like a real man. And he is so evil. He is so horrifying. And the girl brings his, you know, food to him.
And in the meantime, even the wife had died. I think they say that his young wife had died, so God knows what he did. And he's like hiding behind a house of cards looking at her. And then when he sees her, he knocks him down.
Yeah, it was really scary, but I thought the wife left him or died. She wasn't happy.
She wasn't happy. I heard the wife at the beginning died. I think that's what I remember, that she had died, and he still lived in his all his scabby horror or whatever.
But as soon as he sees her, he's just all over her. And, you know, like I said, all she was doing was bringing the meal. She was a servant girl. And what they should have done is the guard should have said, here, give her a smock and cover up the breast, and maybe none of that would have happened.
Well, they would have been thinking.
But like I said, it was just evil, and as soon as the Baron starts saying this girl, I think she bit him when he was trying
to... He goes for it, and she, like, bit him, and then they come in, and they go, take her to the dungeon.
So they throw her in the dungeon. Okay, I mean, like I said, the guy was just, he was more cartoony, more evil.
And they throw her in the dungeon with the beggar, who's been there for, like, 20 years.
Now, that's one thing about the Hammer films. I don't want to say a formula, but there's certain, besides the breast they always have, a lot of times, most of the people are very good and very kind.
Yeah.
But they always have some man that's very lecherous. You know, lecherous
and,
males.
And
know,
evil.
One of them. And, but anyway, they throw her in the dungeon. Okay. Well, the beggar, her friend, is there. By this time, he's like the hairy man. You know,
he's out of his mind.
And immediately he sees her, and she gets frightened. And then he runs over to her, and that's it. And then finally shows her clothes are all ripped off, her hair's all messed up. And then the guards, you know, she's begging for help. She can't speak, you know, but the guards say, oh, you finally come to your senses. take her back up.
And he's dead, and the beggar's dead. He did her, and then he died. I mean, it was too good for him. It was too much for his weak, frail heart.
It's like he turned into a rabbit.
Yeah, he's dead. So yeah, they take her up to the to see the Baron, and she's got a knife behind her.
Yeah, she takes care of, and she escapes. And I'm thinking, okay. Well, next thing you know, she's in another part of Spain.
She's living in the woods.
And this family takes her in.
They find her, like, in a lake or something like that.
But it's a couple. They're landowners.
Yeah.
And they bring her in, and she's with child, which is bad at any time if you're not married, but especially then it was unthinkable.
And think of that. And dad is going to be, was the beggar guy, you know, that was all a mess, but anyway. There's a lot of unpleasantness going on, you know.
So far. They brought in a Catholic priest, you know, the village or whatever.
And then they start with I think she's expecting on Christmas Day, and they're all talking about the superstitions of Christmas Day that you don't want to have a kid because it's insulting to, you know, the Jesus Christ. And then they start. That's when they start doing all the, you know, the mystical. Whatever for the werewolf.
See, I never heard that before.
I never heard that before either, you know, honestly. But I guess this movie is based on a book called The Werewolf of Endor Werewolf of Paris by Guy Endor. I don't know if that's in there or not, but, you know, obviously, like we were talking before, this movie was supposed to be based in. This movie originally was going to become an Inquisition, was going to be made into an Inquisition movie by Hammer, but the censors turned it down, so they turned it into a werewolf movie, and they used that novel as the basis for it. But instead of being the Werewolf of Paris, he became the Werewolf of Spain.
Well, see, that's something, when you told me that earlier, I was kind of surprised, because the movie didn't make too much sense to me. Because he became a werewolf because of all the bad curse that was happening earlier, I guess. I couldn't quite figure out why.
Okay, I watched it today, this morning, and screw it up a little bit, but the impression that I got was there was a scene where the priest is talking to the man who found her, and said, like, you know, well, you know, she has the baby, but the baby is born, like, on Christmas, and then when he's born, there's, like, the wolf baying in the background.
Mm. Mm.
And then the kid starts to grow up, but, you know, the, like, all the weird things start to happen, you know? It was like he's having bad dreams, and, like, you know, and that's when they find him shot. I don't remember the exact way, but what basically happened is that the kid grows up, and then, like, he was out with one of the local villagers, and the villager was hunting,
right.
And the villager shot, like, a squirrel.
Or
an animal. And when he saw that, he felt bad for the little animal. And then he basically, like, you know, tried to kiss the wound. And when the kid says when he kissed the wound, the blood tasted like sugar, and he started feeling weird. And that's when he started having the bad dreams. So the bad dreams were that he was kind of becoming like a little werewolf and escaping and, like, killing animals. And that's when he got shot. And that's the scene you're talking about, when he came back and they found a bullet in him. And then when he showed the dad the hairy palms, then that was, like, the thing. And then I think after that is when the dad was talking to a priest, and the priest said that whole thing about how, like, well, sometimes, you know, when children are born, there's evil spirits floating around, and sometimes the evil spirits, they won't go into a person who dies because of, like, rigor mortis sets in instantly, but when it's a newborn, sometimes the spirit finds its way, and... Yeah, you know, that was their whole...
Oh, so they're saying that the beggar was... No, it wasn't a beggar.
They're saying that the evil spirit came from, like, from the sky, and it got into the young baby when he was born.
See, that's not enough for me. That's not convincing.
Yeah, it was. I've never heard that. I've never heard that idea before, you know.
Well,
that
it was going to be an Inquisition movie, do you know anything about that? Like, what the plot was?
No, they didn't say it. They didn't show it. When I read about it, they didn't say what the plot was, but what they said was the censor read it, and he said, too bloody, not going to happen.
Yeah.
So, basically, another thing that happened, too, was when the baby was going to get baptized, the holy water was boiling up, And then even in the holy water, you saw the face of like reflection of like a beast, and that was another sign that there was something wrong with the kid. But at that point, they figured out that by like taking care of the kid and loving him, he wouldn't turn into a wolf, you know.
Well, and
that's what the priest told him. He said, look.
And that's one thing, the priest, he, you know, even though they saw all these things, the priest still went through it and told them what to do, and they did do it. And basically, the boy grew up and was fine. I guess they built bars around this place. So
they built bars. And there was one cool scene, which you probably remember, too, where, like, they went into the room because the kid was screaming, and he was holding, he was grabbing to the bar, but he had a little werewolf fangs. And I want to remember from when I was a kid. That freaked me out a little bit.
Yeah, and that's, like I said, those are images I always remembered. But, like I said, they did what the priest said. The priest didn't, like, carry on and get a mob of angry villagers to kill him. He stood by and explained what to do. It was all love, which I appreciated.
Yeah, you know? and then he grew up to be Oliver Reed, who was
Maybe if he would grew up to be a less evil-looking person, he would have been okay. You know.
The thing was that the kid looked like Oliver Reed.
Yeah.
Kind of, which was a good casting.
You know? It wasn't. When I was watching it even now, I think, wow, he grew up okay, and that's what it looks like.
Yeah.
And I have to say. Whenever I see Oliver Reed was a fine actor. When I watched it, I liked it, but I can't get past the fact that he was the evil dad in Tommy.
Yeah, and all, in other movies too.
Yeah, and that's like I said, I can't see him as a leading man or anything like
that. He did a horrid movie, man. It was Ken Russell. He called The Devils. It was about the Inquisition, and it was just horrible. I remember seeing the movie theater. There was like nuns getting killed, and he's like shaved his head, and they crucify him and they break his. It's just a horrible, rough movie.
I'll tell you, the Inquisition is something that
it's a horror, man.
I'm not Catholic. I'm not European. I wasn't alive at the time, but when I read these things, it's horrifying.
Yeah, well, I'm Spanish and Catholic, so.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I get concerned for my friend. But no, it's something. I'm interested to find out what that movie was supposed to be because.
We'll investigate it.
It makes sense that basically they couldn't do it, so they took what they had and shoehorned into something else, because it doesn't really quite make sense. I mean, when I say this, it was a movie I couldn't stop watching. I mean,
it's beautiful. It's a beautiful looking movie.
And I'm cheering for Oliver Reed. You know, Oliver Reed was a fine young man who decided to go out and find his way, and his step-parents, you know, were very loving, and they said goodbye, and he went. And he went on, and even though he wasn't treated well by his boss or his boss's future son-in-law, he was a good man.
Yeah.
He was doing everything right, and, I mean, you're cheering for the guy. And so, like I said, that's the thing of him turning to a werewolf didn't make sense to me. And the stuff that comes later, I'm thinking, well, the guy just would have given it a good chance. He would have been a fine human being. He started out fine.
Yeah, he started out fine, but it was like he still was kind of like cursed by the usual full moon.
Right.
And then he meets when he goes out on his own, he gets a job at a wine factory.
Right.
And then he falls in love with the daughter of the owner, but the owner's got the daughter set up with another rich guy.
Right, but the daughter fell in love with him as well. It wasn't like, you know, him doing any wrong.
Yeah.
And so basically, if he wasn't cursed. And
he was cursed at birth.
And the woman's father wasn't a jerk. He would have been okay.
He would have been okay because there was that one scene where, like, he was starting to. There was a scene in it where, remember, where he's starting to feel like the urges when it's a full moon, and she stays the night with him, and the next morning he didn't turn into a werewolf. So once again, the love kept him from turning into the monster that he became.
Yeah, his step-parents' love is what the priest told him.
And the girl's love turned him into, he kept him from becoming a monster.
So, if you have a daughter, don't try to make your daughter marry for money. The guy, Oliver Reed, could have, you know, helped the father take over the winery, you know, do fine.
And he would have been great.
Everything would have been fine. And he says, the daughter wouldn't have been unhappy. All those villagers didn't have to die. Oliver Reed didn't have to be shot down in a bell tower.
No. Well, anyway, we're getting ahead of ourselves there. So anyway, once, you know, that's set up, and, you know, with a girl, and she can cure him, and blah, 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 blah. But then, like, she can't see him all the time because the father wants her to go see the other guy. So he makes his buddy, the other wine, the other worker at the wine factory, says, look, why don't you come with me out? We're going to go out to the clubs. We're going to have a good time and drink and blah, blah, blah. So Oliver Reed goes, "Oh yeah, I'm not doing anything tonight, so yeah, let's go." So of course, you know, trouble's going to happen at that point.
Yeah, but like I said, I didn't find anything bad. I mean,
they go well. They go out and they're having a part. They're going into like a casino of sorts.
Yeah.
But then the full moon starts coming out, and of course, if he doesn't have the love of somebody, you know what's going to happen.
Yeah, what it was, they had a lot of women there, really beautiful women with low cut brow blouses.
Of course.
Which, of course, we're fans of.
Yeah, and Hammer.
But people are drinking, they're gambling, and then this one girl takes pity on him and brings him up to her room. Of course, then she's trying to make some money, you know, and
yeah,
which is her job, but yeah, it's paid love isn't real love. Always remember that, boys.
That's right.
And girls.
Yeah.
And so yeah, it wasn't real love, and the full moon came out, and he turned into a werewolf, and then
because it was already established before that he was going to turn into a werewolf when there was a full moon, unless there was somebody there to calm him down.
Right.
I think it was established already, so he didn't have his girlfriend there, and he must have forgotten that it was going to be a full moon. So he turns into, at that point, he turns into full werewolf mode and like kills like three people, kills that woman.
Well, he kills his coworker, doesn't he?
Kills a coworker.
Which is his friend.
And I think he kills some other guy, I think. And then what happened later? I think after he does all that, he ends up back at his house, and he's laying in bed, and the parents see him there. What are you doing here? And you can see that the bars to his room were open. I guess he must have crawled in as a werewolf and opened the bars,
right.
And he's lying there, and the parents are like, you know, what are you doing? And, you know, and he's like, you know, he's all freaking out or whatever, and they're like, oh my God, you know, what are we going to do now, and whatever. So, but anyway, he goes back, and then the police start investigating him, and then they're asking him questions about where he was, and this and that, and the other thing, and I guess somehow or another, they link him to the three murders.
Yeah, they trace him down, they know it was him, they're talking about how his co-worker was dead, and he killed him.
Yeah, they link him to the three murders, but they can't 100% prove him, so then the parents come down to the jail with a priest, and the priest tries to talk the jailer into, listen, this guy, you know, they're trying to convince him of this, and since there's a priest there, I guess the jailer's starting to believe it a little bit, and they go, look, put him in a monastery, I don't think he did anything, but he's got issues, he's got problems. I don't know if they told him he was a werewolf, but, you know, but he didn't do it, but he's not normal, blah, blah, blah. So they're getting ready to let him go, and then the girl shows up and finds out that he's in jail, and then she's like, oh, my God, you know, you got to let him out, you got to let him out. And then the jailer starts, like, talking to the girl, and the jailer's like, well, you know him? She goes, yeah. He goes, well, do you know him as a normal, regular man? She goes, yeah. And then the jailer goes, well, forget that. You know, there's nothing wrong with him. Keep him in jail and leave him there. So then he stays in jail. And, of course, the full moon, you know, comes out. And then he turns into werewolf mode again. And he goes on another rampage. And then, of course, the ending we were talking about before. He goes on a rampage. He gets up, of course, like in the classic Universal or Hammer, you know, format. He gets up on the roof and he's like, you know, the people are down. The villagers are down with the fire and all that, and they're throwing like stuff at him. Of course, like by somebody throwing like, you know, a fire out there, they throw it. Of course, they hit like a bale of hay, and he throws it back at him.
And then,
yeah, like what do you expect, you know? And then you know the ending is that there was the villager, the guy who guarded the animals for the local constable or whatever, he had a silver bullet, and the dad took it, and the dad at the end ends up shooting him in the bell tower there.
Yeah, because it was the groundskeeper, the guy that was supposed to be
the groundskeeper. Yeah. He had the silver bullet to kill the werewolf.
When he was talking about his wife, he took a silver cross and melted it down to
that's
make
right.
a bullet.
Yeah, that's right. He took a silver crown.
Because he was perplexed, because he did shoot that beast, and everybody was mad that, you know, he was getting their goats. He says, "I know, I shot it." So
and he shot another animal too. He shot another wolf,
and
thinking that he got him.
Yeah, he thought he got it, but then something happened, and that's when I don't know. I didn't quite catch why, but he did say he took a cross.
No, they showed it. He took the wife's cross from the wall and he melted it and formed it into a bullet with some.
But why? What was the reason? Why would he do that for a bullet? I mean,
silver bullets kill werewolves.
Well, exactly. We know that, but why made him think that?
I guess they were superstitious. I don't know. I mean, that wasn't explained either.
Here's one thing in the movie. Everybody was actually really good, nice people, even the jailer. And if the Baron wasn't such a jerk, none of this would have happened.
Well, the Baron and the father of the girl was a jerk,
the wine owner and his future, hopefully, son-in-law
were jerks.
Were the three people that were just awful. And one thing when we were watching the movie, Al mentioned, which I did think, was the love interest wasn't a typical Hammer girl.
No.
I mean, she was a very attractive lady. I liked her. But a little mousy for some of these Hammer ladies.
Yeah, she was.
Frightening, but I mean, nevertheless, she was very beautiful, and I thought she was attractive, and she seemed like a nice lady.
I mean, that might have been their way of, like, giving you a visual that she's a good girl, you know? Yeah. I mean, she didn't show much skin like the other ones did. She was, like, pretty chaste and pretty covered up.
Like a fine lady.
Yeah, exactly. I think that was their way of, like, showing that, as opposed to some of the other... Even though the mom was a nice woman, but she was showing a lot of cleavage. But the other women, when they went to the casino or the gambling establishment or whatever, they were all pretty loose and, drunk and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, definitely he was, the main gist of the movie was he was cursed, and the only thing that could save him was love. And the only thing that killed him, in a way, was love, because it was his adopted father that killed
him.
That idea was actually echoed later in the films of a Spanish actor who did a lot of horror movies called Paul Naschy. He did his remakes of a lot of the... His main series of movies is a werewolf character he did called Waldemar Daminski. And the whole thing about him was that he can only be killed by a woman who loves him. So he's taken the idea of Curse of the Werewolf, because obviously, since Curse of the Werewolf was filmed in Spain, well then, hey, that's kind of like me, but Naschy was a big fan of all the Universal horror movies and all the classic horror movies, so he took it upon himself to play a lot of those characters in his B movies that were mostly in the 70s, a few in the 60s, and he went on through the 2000s, but the best ones were in the 70s and 80s. So he kind of like took over that mantle, and he became the Spanish werewolf. But the first Spanish werewolf was Oliver Reed in Curse of the Werewolf, which I think is a really good movie. I still like it.
And when I say that, I'm kind of putting the film down. I do like the movie, and I really enjoyed the movie, and that's when I told Al I'm not giving the setback.
Yeah, right.
But I guess to me, I love the Hammer films for how they look. I love the color. All the things we're talking about, I really enjoy. But I think what really makes these special is the stories. They're unique.
Yeah, they're different.
What was it? The Brides of Dracula was just very clever and unique.
We'll do that one next time. But that's almost like Dracula as a mama's boy.
But yeah, exactly. But it was something I never thought. Some of the stuff they did, I thought was unique. And Kiss of the Vampire?
That was different, too.
That was really different. And that was a story that you just couldn't look away from. It wasn't a typical Bela Lugosi. I love Bela Lugosi's Dracula. But
yeah.
These were unique. And, Night Creatures, Nightmare, all these stories, it was like Twilight Zone. They were really great stories that kind of caught you, and you weren't really sure what to happen.
The writer was a guy named, most of them anyway, it was a guy named Jimmy Sangster.
Really?
Yeah. They had a guy who did a lot of them, and he was a great writer. I don't know, I think he did them all the way to the end, but after a while, I don't know if the first one was by Sangster, but I think the best ones were by Sangster. He took it over for a while, but then they got other writers later on.
But, the Curse of the Werewolf, like I said, it was kind of like, it wasn't convincing me of what was happening, and that's what I told you.
It's possible because it wasn't the original intention.
Well, exactly.
Maybe it was a little half-baked.
They shoehorned something in that, they should have just stopped and done something else. But, when I say that, I guess they already had money riding on it and they had to do something. It's a movie that is worth watching. It's a movie I did enjoy. It's just of all of them, well, except for one other, it was one of my least favorite films.
Nevertheless, I liked it.
It's worth watching.
I liked it. I like the makeup.
Yeah, it's a good movie.
I like the actors. Oliver Reed was really good in it. I mean, some of the other actors were like Hammer regulars. There was there was a guy called Michael Ripper, who was the old guy in the jail with him or whatever. He's in like every Hammer movie. And there was a bunch of, Yvonne Romain was in a few more Hammer movies. I think she was in Bond movies too, I think. I'm not sure. So they had their own group of people. But this is one of the first ones that didn't have Christopher Lee or Peter Cushing.
Right.
This was a completely different,
Well, if it doesn't have one of those men, usually the movie has Oliver Reed.
He's in a lot of them. Yeah. He's in a lot of them. I think right before this, they did Hound of the Baskervilles. So I don't know really? Why. Yeah, they did. Hammer did Hound of the Baskervilles. And I think it was in 59 with Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing. They did like the first three or four, and then Lee didn't want to do Brides of Dracula, but Cushing did it. And then I think, I don't know if this one came out after Brides of Dracula, but Hound of the Baskervilles was a little bit before that. And then The Mummy had Cushing and Lee again. And then I think Oliver Reed started doing a lot of the, I think he was in the Black and White ones. He was either in Paranoia.
Yeah, he was in both of those.
Or he was Black either in Nightmare. And he started doing the pirate movies, doing the Pirates of Blood River and a few of the adventure ones. And then he later on went and had, of course, his own career. But he did quite a few Hammer movies. I think at least six or seven, at least.
Yeah, well, they were just unique.
It was a way for young actors to, you know, break into the business. Because Hammer, regardless of how good they looked, they were, in a way, they weren't real big budget movies. Right. They were good budget movies, but they weren't. And these Hammer movies influenced a lot of those Edgar Allan Poe movies that Roger Corman did with Vincent Price. Those were influenced by these movies.
Yeah, it seemed like Vincent Price should have been in some of these movies.
Yeah, he did a couple of movies in Britain later on, but he was never. And these are all British casts.
But I'll tell you, seeing some of these, and I didn't realize Hound of the Baskervilles. I remember seeing that on TV when I was a kid, and they advertised that pretty heavy as well.
The Christopher Lee one?
I'm guessing that was.
Or the Basil Rathbone one?
No, it was a newer one. It was in the mid '70s, and they were advertised on TV.
There's a lot of Sherlock Holmes. The one that came out was a color one. It was made around the same time. It had the same brilliant
color. I think that was the one they showed on TV, because it was in 74.
Maybe.
And one of my best friends, that's all he talked about. I didn't watch it. I remember all the advertising for it.
Was it like a local station that was promoting it as a movie of the week?
I think it was ABC.
Don't
quote me, because I didn't see the show. I just remember they were always advertising on ABC.
Okay.
Like a big event. But a lot of these films, I do remember, they were pushing and talking about, you know, hey, we're showing this, we're showing like the Phantom of the Opera. And they did. I just didn't realize they were all Hammer horror films. I just, you know.
And this was, you saw it on primetime?
Well, I didn't watch it. It was on primetime, yes.
It wasn't like a late night movie that they were promoting
No, I think it was on primetime.
Huh, okay.
But don't quote me, I could be wrong.
Well, because I do remember, I remember at least in 1969 or 70, I remember on primetime, they used to have, before ABC did their made-for-TV movies, they used to show a movie of the week.
Yeah.
And it was a theatrical movie. I remember seeing Pit and the Pendulum.
Yes.
Yeah. You remember that too, huh? Yeah. One night. I remember I was over at somebody's house and I was like, freaked me out. I was like, whoa.
Was that a Hammer film?
That was not a Hammer film, but it looks like a Hammer film. That was an American International Picture made in 1961, around the time that these movies were being made. But yeah, that was on the ABC Movie of the Week. So it's possible that there was an ABC Movie of the Week and they had...
I think that's what it was.
The Phantom of the Opera with Robert Lahm, the Hammer one. Because, yeah, it would make sense that they would show a color one. They're not going to show a black and white movie.
Well, no, but the Phantom of the Opera was shown on a CBS affiliate.
It was a CBS.
And I think that was local. I don't know if that was a national one. It could have been.
And you're thinking what year this was?
72.
The 72, and in the summer maybe.
Yeah, it was in the summer.
You know what? I'm gonna go on Google newspapers later on and look through, because if it played, it was a CBS movie. It would have been playing in South Florida as well.
Well, one thing Oklahoma did a lot, like they didn't show Saturday Night Live the first couple of years it was on.
Because they showed Crack Gregor.
No, they didn't show it. He wasn't on, but they just showed a movie. You know, I watched Lawrence of Arabia one night and they showed stuff like that. And they just wouldn't show Saturday Night Live. And I go down to Texas for the weekend and see, what is this show? And but we didn't get Saturday Night Live the first year or first couple of years, maybe. The whole time Chevy Chase was on, we never saw. And sometimes Oklahoma would show something locally instead of showing the prime time stuff. I don't know why, but I just remember that would happen sometimes. They just decided they didn't want to show it, and they wouldn't. You know, like I said, Family Opera could have been a CBS thing, but I just remember in Oklahoma, everybody stopped what they're doing and watched it. It was a big event. You know, they were advertising it heavily.
Hmm.
And from what I understood, I thought it was a local thing, but it could have been national.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. Like I said, when I was a kid, they used to play big pictures like on, you know, in primetime on ABC. I think this might have even been before Monday Night Football. You know, it must have been like 69 or 68 or something. And then when they got Monday Night Football, then they would do that. And then by the early 70s, they started making their own movie of the week, and then they stopped doing it. But they would still have a special.
This was CBS that did it.
Okay. Yeah, CBS. The only CBS movie that I remember was the nighttime movies, but they might have had primetime movies. I don't remember.
Well, it was primetime because we never stayed up when I was that young.
Okay, and it was in the summer, so you didn't have school, so you could stay up.
My whole family watched it.
You think it was like a Friday or a Monday or something?
Well, I thought it was a Saturday, but you gotta remember I was a kid. You know,
Saturday
like,
night at the movies, yeah.
I was like 9 or 10.
Well, anyway, that was The Curse of the Werewolf. This was, go see it. If you go get this box set, the Hammer Horror series, it's a really good one. You can get it at Amazon for like $15 or something
but
like that.
There's so many more Hammer films.
There's like 200.
Yeah, like I said, there's a plethora.
But the early ones are the best ones.
Yeah, but the ones I remember are the ones I've seen recently. They're very unique.
They're different.
Yeah, they are different. I can't stop watching them when they come on, so...
All right, well, Don, thanks for being on the show.
We'll
do The Bride of Dracula next, and and as Porky Pig would say, that's all, folks.
Man.
Find Al's other podcast, Slow Robot A Go Go, Dallas's webcomic, The Mighty Blue, and Al's blog, Destination Nightmare, on the sidebar of our blog at bunchofdorks.com.
And click on the Cyclops!